Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Today, we're talking with someone who is going to demystify the art form that is social skills. Dr. Elizabeth Loggison is an associate clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Biobehavioral Sciences at the UCLA Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior, and she is a licensed clinical psychologist as well. Dr. Loggison is the founder and director of the UCLA Peers Clinic, which is an outpatient program providing evidence-based social skills training for individuals with neurodevelopmental disabilities and other social challenges across the lifespan. Dr. Loggison is the author of The Science of Making Friends, Helping Socially Challenged Teens and Young Adults. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, Signa.
Dr. Loggison, I was thinking that it would be a good starting place to talk about the social landscape of adolescence and adulthood.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. It's pretty simple. I mean, I think that we all know that, you know, in terms of our own social landscape, you know, you have people that are sort of your acquaintances, right? People you just kind of know so-so. You have some casual friends. These are the people you know a little bit better than an acquaintance, right? There's maybe online friends for some people. There's regular friends, the people that are kind of in your same social circle. You got probably have things in common with them. And then there's your best friends. And most people have, you know, a couple or a few best friends. And this is true, you know, once you hit adolescence and on and through adulthood, you know, there's these different sort of categories of friendships. But really friendships, close friendships that include things like regular friends and best friends, are often really based on common interests. You know, Signa, if you think about who you're friends with, you probably have things in common with them, right? And those Yes. are the things that you probably do together and you talk about when you're together. Is that right?
It's exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. So when we're trying to help our kids sort of who are struggling in the social landscape to sort of navigate that landscape, part of it is just decoding that social landscape and talking about the fact that, you know, friendships are often based on common interests. So thinking about where we might meet other people with common interests is a really good starting point to thinking about developing friendships.
I remember in reading your book, The Science of Making Friends, you talked about how parents will initially think that the Peers Clinic at UCLA is going to be a great place for their children or their teen to make other friends. Like, oh, we're going to go to this place with teens, with other teens that have social difficulties, and that's going to be a great way for them to make friends. But you say, actually, that's not the idea.
No, I mean, friendships do develop often in our program. I mean, I'm not going to pretend like that does happen, but it's not the purpose of why we have kids come to our program. We're trying to teach them how to make and keep friends outside of our program. And I'll often use this analogy. I'm sure you've heard this analogy before about teaching a person to fish versus giving them a fish, right? You've probably heard that before. You give someone a fish, you know, you feed them for a day. But if you teach them to fish, you feed them for life. And so the idea behind the Peers program really is to teach kids how to make and keep friends, you know, outside of our program. If friendships happen to develop in the program, that's great. But we really are there to teach them how to do this outside of this small little, you know, microcosm of the world.
I see. And it would a first step be the question that I started with, like really having them step back and take a look at the social landscape?
Yes, absolutely. Maybe even further back, look at yourself. Look at what are your interests? What do you like to do? What do you like to talk about? And then look at the social landscape and say, well, who else likes to do those things? And where can I find them? So if I'm really into, for example, video games, I really love video games. I'm good at them. Imagine that. Well, okay, who else likes video games? Well, the gamers, right? I mean, there's a whole group out of there with the people called the gamers. And how do you identify them? Well, they're probably walking around school with gaming devices. They're probably playing video games before and after school. They're probably joining gaming clubs, right? They've got little gaming logos on their t-shirts, right? That's part of decoding the social world is first thinking about, well, what do I like? What do I want to talk about? What do I want to do with my potential friends? And then identifying other people that have those same interests.
What about the categories of peer acceptance? You talked about it in your book. Can you tell us more about those categories?
Yeah, there's been some really interesting research that's been done, you know, over the decades, really, that look at categories of peer acceptance and, you know, a typical middle school or high school, for example. And what these researchers do is they'll go into a middle school or high school and they'll ask kids to identify who they like, who they're friends with, maybe who they don't like so much. And they identify these different categories of peer acceptance. And what they found is that about half of kids, maybe around 55% of kids, are sort of in the average range of peer acceptance, meaning that they're doing well socially. They have friends. They're not necessarily popular, but you know, they're doing well. They have friends, they're well-liked. Then you have another group of kids that's about 15 to 17% of kids that are considered popular. But popular doesn't necessarily mean well-liked.
I see.
It means well-known, right? So it doesn't mean that they're not liked. It just means well-known. So you do get some of those controversial kids in there, sometimes like the bullies or the gossips, you know, maybe not so well-liked, but definitely well-known. And then you have another 15% of kids that are peer rejected. Now, these are the kids who are actively seeking out their peers, but they're actively getting pushed away. So they're doing things that other people maybe don't like. Maybe they're barging into conversations, kind of off topic. Maybe they're talking about the same thing over and over. Maybe they're doing this thing I call it policing. They're telling everybody what they're doing wrong all the time, that kind of, you know, and they're getting rejected. They're trying to socially engage others, but they're getting rejected. Those are the peer rejected kids. On top of that, you have another 15% of kids who are socially neglected. Now, these kids look very different from the peer rejected kids. They're struggling socially too, but they're not even trying to socially engage their peers. So they're often seen as shy or timid. They're often kind of withdrawn and they go unnoticed. But the difference is they're not even trying to engage other people. And so what this data tells us, this peer sociometric data, is that about in any typical middle school across North America, there's probably about one third of kids who are struggling socially. And it's not just kids that, you know, you would naturally think maybe struggle socially, maybe kids on the autism spectrum, for example, you know, they're often known to struggle socially. There's a lot of kids off the spectrum as well that are struggling socially.
With the kids that are in the category of socially neglected, I remember reading about it in your book. And I found it particularly interesting because you said these kids are not kids that have a quote-unquote bad reputation. They're kids that don't have a reputation at all. And not only do they end up being socially neglected by their peers, that sometimes they're neglected by teachers and adults as well.
Yeah, they often go unnoticed because they're not speaking up in class. They're not engaging other people. And, you know, if you look at mental health conditions across those two groups, the peer rejected and the socially neglected, you see a lot more anxiety and depression in the socially neglected kids. And again, they're not engaging others, so they go unnoticed, but there can be some significant consequences for that kind of social neglect. And then if you look at the kids who are peer rejected, they tend to have more of like the impulse control issues, you know, things like ADHD, kind of acting more impulsively, maybe with other people, maybe more intrusive. They are definitely more noticeable. Those are the ones that stand out.
Right.
And as you say, they sometimes will have bad reputations with their peers. They sometimes get teased or bullied. And there's a lot of significant mental health conditions that result from that. So even though those peer rejected kids might initially sort of present with things like ADHD and impulse control issues, because the rejection that they experience is such a strong predictor of mental health conditions later in life, they're probably more likely to experience things like anxiety and depression later in life. So you get these kids who maybe at one point were peer rejected, now they're socially neglected because now they've given up.
They're not even trying anymore. And would you see at the Peers Clinic, which I should mention stands for Program of the Education and Enrichment of Relational Skills Clinic. Would you see more of the peer rejected group at your clinic or socially neglected?
We see both.
You see both.
I think we see roughly equally, really.
And if someone who's socially neglected and doesn't present as someone who is interested in making friends? How do you sort that out?
Yeah, I mean, we don't force social skills onto anyone. So these are families that are coming to us saying, my kid's struggling socially, or, you know, a young adult coming to us saying, I'm having trouble making and keeping friends and I want some help. And, you know, a lot of times if it's a parent that's calling, we also need to confirm with that teen or even that young adult that they actually want to participate in our program. So the first step is just, do they want to be there? Do they want to learn the skills that we're teaching? But we don't actively go out and sort of force social skills onto people. So it doesn't seem to be a problem where, you know, you might have a socially neglected person that maybe doesn't have interest in making and keeping friends, we're not going to see that person in our clinic. Same thing with the peer rejected person. If they're perfectly fine with where they're at, that's their choice. You know, one of the sayings we have in our program, you probably read this a lot in my book, is that science, you know, friendship is a choice.
Yes.
You know, we don't get to be friends with everybody, and we don't, you know, everyone doesn't get to be friends with us, but also just choosing to have friends, you know, that is in itself a choice.
I actually really thought quite a bit about this idea of friends are a choice. And the thing that really stood out to me is that if the paradigm is friends are a choice, then it sounds like it really also reduces the likelihood of unhealthy and kind of abusive relationships.
Absolutely. I mean, we really start our program with even just brainstorming, like, what are the characteristics of a good friend? Right. And really going through the list of like all of these different characteristics, things like, well, we mentioned common interests are important, but also things like, you know, honesty and trust, loyalty, commitment, kindness, you know, understanding, mutual respect, the ability to resolve conflict, equality, all of these characteristics and more are important. And so not every friendship has all of those characteristics. And there's different types of friendships. This is another area that we have to begin with, you know, talking about. You know, some of our kids will think that, oh, I play video games with my neighbor. That's my best friend. But maybe they never talk to that person and they don't really know anything about them. Well, it doesn't mean that that's not their friend. It's just a different type of friendship, right? It's maybe their gaming buddy or something. It's more of a casual friend. There's different types of friendships. And so thinking about the quality of those friendships and the type of friendship is a good place to start when talking about making and keeping friends.
I imagine that we've all experienced wanting to be friends with somebody that maybe doesn't have great chemistry with us, or someone feeling like they have great chemistry with us and we don't want to be such good friends with them. If somebody's really wanting to be your good friend and you're not feeling the same way, is there a way to do that gently?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the first steps in sort of acknowledging that friendship is a choice and deciding what type of friendship this is, or if it is in fact even a friendship, is to think about, you know, acceptance and the signs of acceptance. Mm. We don't want to force ourselves on to other people, and people are often giving us very subtle signs,
yes,
about whether or not they want to be friends with us. So, you know, a lot of parents will say, or even kids will say, well, how can you tell if somebody wants to be friends with you? Well, look at the data. Right? How can you tell somebody wants to be friends with you? Well, if you try to exchange numbers with them, they'll give you their number. If you text them, they text you back, right? If you invite them to something, they accept your invitation. They seek you out. They invite you to things. They accept your friend requests on social media. These are all good signs that you're being accepted. And how can you tell if you're not being accepted? Sort of the opposite of all of that, right? They don't exchange numbers with you. Or if you text them, they don't text you back, or they give very, very short replies. They don't invite you to things. They don't accept your invitations. And while that can sound very depressing to hear that you're being rejected by someone to a certain extent, we have to remember that friendship is a choice, right? We don't get to be friends with everyone, and everyone doesn't get to be friends with us. And this is true for everyone. And we don't want to force friendships onto people who don't want to be friends with us. That's not a good choice. So instead, let's focus on people who do want to be friends with us, people that we have things in common with. Let's not go to the negative of how horrible it is to not be able to be friends with everybody we want to. How about let's just make some good choices?
You just answered my next question, which was, how do we soften that rejection or not personalize it as much? But there it is, right?
Yeah.
It's like, instead of focusing on the people who might not want to be friends with us, let's focus on the people that really get us and see the essence, yeah, of us.
Exactly. Just normalize that. And yeah, focusing on the good choices, not the bad choices.
Okay. Can you tell us more about what neurodivergence means?
Yeah, of course. You know, neurodivergence is a relatively new term, and it simply means that, you know, someone who thinks differently from the majority of society, right? It usually refers to and often refers to autistic individuals, but it actually can include people who experience other, you know, conditions related to difficulty with cognition or social ability. People, for example, with ADHD, with OCD, with Tourette's, you know, these could also be considered people who are neurodiverse.
It's interesting. With permission, a client and I were talking about my upcoming interview with you today, and she has ADHD, and she was speaking about how difficult it is for her to remember somebody's name and some of the things that they're talking about. It affects her ability to have what you call follow-up questions. Can you say a little more about that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people who are neurodivergent have difficulty with things like social communication. That's kind of what you're describing there. And so this is difficulty having reciprocal conversations. And there's a lot of social, you know, errors that can happen in social communication. One would be difficulty, and the example you used is asking follow-up questions. Well, if you're having difficulty asking follow-up questions, then you might end up making the social error of just kind of topic switching, right? You'd be basically switching from topic to topic and not really staying on any topic for any, you know, length of time if you're not asking follow-up questions. And so we're trying to figure out and decode for our young people, well, what are the rules of good conversational skills? And what are the kind of do's and don'ts of that? And so we want to teach that when we're teaching young people how to make and keep friends. Because really, by the time you hit middle school, you need to know how to carry on a conversation with someone. You know, when you're younger, you can play on the playground. And as long as you're a good sport and you know how to enter play appropriately, like, you can do okay socially. But once you hit middle school, it's all about being able to talk to people, right? I mean, you still can play games and things, but social communication becomes important. So those reciprocal conversations, we call it trading information, involve a lot of different rules, not just asking follow-up questions, but, you know, finding common interests will be kind of the goal of that conversation. Not being a conversation hog, not being an interviewer, right? Like, also doing things like not policing, not telling people what they're doing wrong, maybe not being argumentative or teasing people. I mean, there's so many do's and don'ts. Those are a lot of don'ts. There's also a lot of do's, you know, things like asking questions and even answering your own question is important. So, for example, if I ask you what you like to do on the weekend, Signe, what might you say if I were to ask you that question?
I like to do collaging. I like to cut out pictures that inspire me in magazines and make collages.
That's very cool. So then I might ask you some follow-up questions around that, right? And then my goal in this conversation is also to find some common interests. I'm not particularly artistic, so I'd probably ask you some more questions about collaging and do you do any other kind of, you know, art forms? And then I might ask you, well, what else do you like to do on the weekends? And what else might you say that you enjoy doing?
I enjoy playing tennis.
Oh, really? I love tennis. Actually, I just started playing pickleball.
Oh, okay. Nice.
So I'm going to time us out for a second because we could go on a whole tangent about tennis and pickleball. But what I did there was I was asking questions, trying to find a common interest, right? And I would have asked more follow-up questions about your collaging, but just to get to the point, then I asked another question, found out that we do have this common interest in tennis. I didn't wait for you to ask me what I like to do. I just answered my own question.
I see. So you didn't wait for me to ask you what your interests are. You let me know that you like, or you asked me another one and gave an answer, then there was a commonality.
Yeah. So I didn't wait. I asked you questions, but in order to keep the conversation going back and forth, I can't rely on the other person to always ask questions of me. I have to share things about myself. So I answered my own question and we found a common interest. And you remember that friendships are based on common interests. So your goal in a conversation is always to find the common interest, right? That's going to be the foundation of something where we can kind of move forward. It doesn't mean that's the only thing we ever talk about, right?
Right.
There's going to be other things we can talk about too. But what we have to do is decode not only the social landscape, but we have to decode, in this case, conversations and figure out what are the do's and don'ts of conversations so that we can actually navigate these interactions.
And a follow-up question, would it be like this, Dr. Loggison, I see you in a social setting after our interview today, and I say, hey, how's the pickleball going?
That's fantastic.
Right? And then we start talking about pickleball and maybe tennis and kind of bring the two together and branch off. Mm-hmm. That gives us a great base, a starting place, and we can branch off to other conversations from there.
Exactly. Follow-up questions can come in that form where they come up, you know, days or weeks later. Follow-up questions also happen right there in the moment. So we discover that we both like tennis. We're going, where do you play tennis? Do you play doubles? Do you play singles? You know, how long have you been playing? Are you pretty good? I mean, these are all follow-up questions.
Right.
And we could also be answering our own questions in the process. So that's why going to, I mentioned, you know, the social landscape. That was one of your first questions. And I mentioned the importance of these different, you know, finding people with common interests. Well, this is where things like peer groups become really important. And, you know, most of the time, by the time you reach adolescence, people are usually starting to congregate around these different peer groups or crowds, right? There's the gamers that I mentioned. There's, you know, techies. They're into technology and computers. There's athletes. There's sports fans. You know, there's anime geeks. There's all kinds of, you know, cosplay, LARPing, what you name it. And the idea here is to find sources of friends so that you can have these interesting conversations and easily find common interests is really helpful if you can find social activities, extracurricular activities, you know, meetup groups with other people that you share interests with. And what you'll find is that having conversations, reciprocal conversations, becomes a lot easier when you're already in a place where you know you have a common interest.
Is that also an example of ecologically valid social skills?
Absolutely. Yes. So going to meetup groups, extracurriculars, and social activities based on your interests is an ecologically valid way to make friends with, you know, people that you have things in common with. You asked the question about, you know, do people come to peers to make friends with other group members? Well, if friendships are based on common interests, having social difficulties is not a common interest, right? It's not a guarantee that people in that group are going to have things to talk about and do together. So that would not be ecologically valid. Instead, what we want to do is find sources of potential friends that they do have things in common with. And that's what kids who, and adults who are socially successful are sort of naturally doing out there in the world. So what we're doing is we're just trying to figure out as researchers, what do socially successful people do? And let's create a whole playbook on that and with rules and steps and share that with people who want to learn those skills. Not everybody wants to learn those skills, so you don't want to force them on people. But for the people who are interested in knowing what the playbook is and what all those rules are, we want to make sure that they're ecologically valid. We're not just making stuff up and telling them what we think they should do.
I loved in the book how you talked about the bad advice that well-meaning adults and parents give to their kid or their teen. Just go up to the group and introduce yourself. And you say that's not ecologically valid. That actually doesn't work so well.
No, I mean, I ask every group of young people that I work with that question. I say, well, what do adults often tell you to do to meet new people? Like imagine you have a kid's first day of school or first day at a new, you know, extracurricular activity. What are they told to do? They're always told to go up and say hi and go up and introduce themselves. But, you know, have you ever thought about what that would look like?
Right.
Like imagine, you know, I just walk up to a group of people, interrupt their conversation, say, hi, I'm Liz.
Right.
You know, what are they going to think of me? They're going to think I'm weird.
And it's so interesting. Right? I never really thought about what that would mean in real time. Because it sounds good, like go up and introduce yourself. But then when you think about it, no, that could lead to peer rejection right off the bat.
Completely. And then if you think about, you know, that's what adults often will tell young people to do. If you think about the socially neglected versus the peer rejected kids, they also make social errors. But it doesn't even tend to be the walking up and saying hi or introducing themselves. The peer rejected kids, remember, those are the ones with impulse control issues. They're likely to barge into the conversation. They'll be off topic. They'll talk about whatever they want to and often not even notice that the group's not accepting them. And that's how they end up often getting kind of like a bad reputation with other people and get rejected. The socially neglected kids, they won't even try, right? They won't even go up to the group of people and talk to them. They'll maybe kind of be like the wallflower, right? Like just kind of like stand there. Maybe they want people to come up and talk to them, but their body language isn't very inviting, right? They're usually like kind of looking down at the ground or at their feet and not really engaging other people. So there's all these social errors that are happening
that
we need to identify and then give them the ecologically valid steps that socially successful people naturally follow.
So if the socially neglected peer, and let's say that we have knowledge that supports that they may want to make a friend or two, it's important to give off the body language, which makes sense. So if, for example, they're on their phone sitting alone, that's not exactly sending off the message, come talk to me.
No, but we can't rely on other people coming up and talking to us. We have to be proactive. So what you start with is you start with those peer groups. You start with, what am I interested in?
Okay.
Where can I find other people that are in this interested in the same thing? So then you've got this potential pool or source of friends, you know, potentially, that have common interests. You go to these activities and then you have to engage people. And it's not by walking up and introducing yourself, right? It's actually really, really simple. It's something that most people probably naturally do, but they don't think about it. The first thing is you're kind of listening to conversations, right? Kind of watching from a distance. You're basically eavesdropping, but you don't want to look like you're eavesdropping, right? So you usually are using a prop like a phone or something to look distracted, but you're really kind of figuring out like, what are they talking about? And also making sure that you know something about the topic, you have a common interest. Let's say you find a common interest. You're not going to yell from across the room, right? You're going to move a little bit closer. Right? You're going to not barge into the conversation. Instead, you're going to wait for a little pause in the conversation, and then you're going to mention the topic. And you do that by either asking a question, making a comment, or giving a compliment, right? That's how you enter conversations. Okay. That's how you meet people. And if things are going well and you're kind of going back and forth, they seem interested in talking to you, then you can introduce yourself. But the introductions come later, if they come at all.
Do you find that pop culture, you know, sometimes pop culture references can be helpful? I'm noticing shows like Atypical. Does Atypical do a decent job depicting neurodivergence?
I think they do, actually. It's funny, I actually consulted on that show early on, and one of the very first scenes in the show where the therapist was teaching the young man how to flirt. Like that was, I worked that out with the writer. It was really interesting because it's a role play that we do
that in our so groups. Cool.
We show what not to do with flirting, like where you're staring at the person with the big toothy smile and the whole thing. Like that's a role play in Peers for Dating. And so they do their homework, and I think they're doing a good job. And not every show, you know, is a perfect depiction. Nothing is. And in fact, there's a saying that if you've met one person with autism, you met one person with autism.
Oh, so I like
that. It's not going to represent everybody. But I do like that, you know, that pop culture is sort of being more, open to neurodiversity. And also I think this is a good reminder for all of us too, that neurodivergence is simply a difference, right? It doesn't mean that a person is less than, right? It's just a difference. And neurodivergent people simply, they think differently from maybe the majority of society. But as neurodivergence is growing and becoming more prevalent, I think it's even more important to be respectful, you know, of neurodiversity. And neurodiversity really just means that society needs to be accepting of diverse ways of thinking, of learning, of processing, you know, of behaving. And so I think that these new, more, you know, prevalent kind of pop culture references, I think, are ultimately good because it's increasing awareness about neurodiversity.
What about jealousy in friendship? Do you have tips for helping to reduce the suffering of perceived rejection or replacement?
Yeah, I mean, good question. I think that, you know, we've probably all experienced this before where you have this very close friend and, you know, friendships change over time. People, and they change because people change over time. Interests change over time. And so this person that you were maybe once close with, maybe you are less close with now. And you remember, I gave you a buzz phrase already for how we deal with these types of rejection. We normalize things by saying friendship is a what?
Friendship is a choice.
That's right. Friendship is a choice.
Friendship is a choice.
We don't get to be, you know, friends or best friends with everyone, and not everyone gets to be friends or best friends with us. And friendships change over time, again, because people change over time. That doesn't mean that that person isn't your friend anymore, but the, maybe the type of friendship that you have with that person changes. And we need to normalize that for everyone. That's true for all of us. Try to find one person on this planet who hasn't had a friendship that has changed over time? It's just a natural thing that happens. And to normalize that for, you know, young people, I think is important so that they don't have to feel this personal sort of rejection. But again, refocusing on, well, let me find other people right. that I can be friends with and other people that, you know, I can be close to. And you don't have to put all your eggs in one basket, right? Like this doesn't have to be your one friend forever. Not many people have that one friend forever. Some people do, and that's precious. But it doesn't have to be like that for everyone, and it often isn't. It's okay yeah. to have friendships change over time. It's quite normal.
Well, Dr. Lagesson, thank you for helping us decode the art and the science of making and keeping friends.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for the important work that you do as well.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. We'll see you next month.